Hi there, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Ian Cook. Today we're talking about Infrastructure Redux, Crisis, Progress in Industrial Pakistan and Beyond by Nausheen H. Anwar. The book came out in 2013 on Palgrave Macmillan, and Nausheen is Assistant Professor of Urban Studies in the Department of Social Sciences at the Institute of Business Administration in Karachi. The book is about infrastructure, as you can imagine, but it's about much more than that as well. It's about these ideas of crisis and these ideas of progress and how they entwine with each other as the state and businesses interact in trying to bring about certain forms of infrastructural development in industrialized regions in Pakistan. I had the pleasure of talking with Nausheen just a few minutes before. Okay, so without any further ado, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Nausheen to the show. Thanks a lot for coming on and thanks a lot for your wonderful book.
Thank you very much, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure. So before turning to the book itself, I was wondering if you could first please tell us a little bit about yourself, what your professional background is and your past research interests and so on.
I am currently living in Karachi, Pakistan, and in Karachi I teach at the Institute for Business Administration, which is a leading university that was set up in the 1950s by the Wharton School. And over there I teach within the Department of Social Sciences. I'm Assistant Professor of Urban Studies. I got my PhD from Columbia University about 7.5 years ago from the Graduate School of Architecture, Planning and Preservation, specifically in urban planning and comparative urban studies. And initially, when I started my research, which was, you know, well over 10 years ago now, my work had focused predominantly on issues of globalization and industrial and economic restructuring in urban regions in South Asia, with a focus on Pakistan. And over the years, however, you know, after considerable reflections, and as I think something that always happens to us in the post-PhD context, over the years, my research has now moved on to different issues concerning infrastructure development and industrialization, but looking also at local and transnational migration dynamics, as well as state and non-state governance issues, and looking not only at cities in Punjab, which I've always been interested in the post-partition context, but also now coming into the southern regions of Pakistan, looking at cities like Karachi and their connectivities with lesser-known towns and villages in provinces like Balochistan, as well as larger linkages with cross-border regions such as Pakistan and Iran. And what interests me today, in terms of how sort of my research has gone on and developed, is the mobility of people and commodities across these different cities and towns, the dynamic flows that are also historically situated and that constitute cities and towns and regions in a globalizing context today in the 21st century. And within these sort of very broad parameters of the research, the more specific issues of precarity and stability for ordinary citizens. So so my work has sort of gone in very different trajectories since the writing of a PhD dissertation, which is essentially what this book is about. It's gone in a very different direction.
So you said this book was based on your PhD, but what was it that made you, what was your motivation for getting this book out, for writing it? What was the sort of drive behind it?
Yeah, so the book essentially is based on my PhD dissertation, and the dissertation itself the core subject of the dissertation is not far off from what the book presents, which is sort of an interrogation of infrastructure collapse in the industrializing regions of Pakistan, looking specifically at the province of Punjab. And however, the dissertation itself was far more technical in its orientation, more positivist in terms of its arguments, and I would say fundamentally more economic development driven, because I had a very overriding concern for thinking about policy outcomes. But over the last seven and a half years, as I've had considerable time to reflect on the dissertation itself and the core arguments, both the questions that I had posed earlier and my motivations to connect with them have changed substantially as the dissertation itself transformed into a manuscript. And I think, in essence, it's not surprising. I think as we sort of sit on our dissertation manuscripts, as we think about how the work evolves in the context of the time in, you know, which we have to reflect in, this is altogether not unsurprising. So in essence, what has happened is that I've moved away from a positivist and policy-oriented reading towards something in which I think about infrastructure and industrial development in more relational terms, something that is more anthropologically and political economy driven, but also very specifically set within the context of Pakistan's post-independence developmental history. And that is a significant change in terms of the transition from a PhD dissertation into a proper manuscript or a book. And within this sort of time period of reflecting and changing sort of the tone of the argument and what has driven it, have been certain nagging questions which have cropped up consistently in the writing of the dissertation and then turning into a manuscript over the last 7 years. And this is essentially that what represents this thing called an infrastructure crisis in Pakistan today. So for the last 20 odd years, and this is, by the way, not exceptional in the Pakistani context, we see this discourse of an infrastructure crisis that circulates also within the context of India and certain other parts of South Asia and even in Africa and certain parts of Southeast Asia. So this is not an exceptional argument in terms of putting forward the Pakistani case of an infrastructure crisis. And with this nagging question of what is exactly this conjuncture of a crisis, how do we represent it, how do we talk about it, one of the issues that kept coming up for me in thinking about this question, reflecting on it, was sort of these contradictory narratives of crisis and progress that are representative of Pakistan's present conjuncture of infrastructure development. And I was trying to come to terms with, how can we link these different narratives of crisis and progress vis-a-vis infrastructure development and industrial development in Pakistan. And after sort of a great deal of reflection and thinking and reading up on certain other scholars' work, especially within the field of anthropology, and there's been a considerable amount of development within anthropology in thinking about infrastructure from different angles and moving beyond the more positivist, economically different readings, I started to link it up with the larger problematic of Pakistan's political economy. So situating these different contradictory narratives of crisis and progress within this shifting, highly unstable political economic landscape in which we see, in essence, the dynamics of political patronage. We see, in essence, these constant connectivities and disconnectivities between the state or different layers of the state and industrialists or firms, and then trying to sort of come up with a core question that and an argument that if we see these contradictory dynamics of crisis and progress vis-a-vis infrastructure's promise of material of the delivery of material progress and development, then how can we structure an argument that sort of fixes this narrative, these contradictory narratives of crisis and progress vis-a-vis Pakistan's current conjuncture. So I began to focus more on the mediatic qualities of infrastructure. It's symbolic mediatic qualities that also pivot on the politics of patronage. And if we start looking at that, then perhaps we can come to terms, with a landscape in which you not only observe an infrastructure collapse, but you also can observe a repairing or a reconstruction or a re-engagement of state firm relations vis-a-vis the redeployment of infrastructure. So you begin to see that both these dynamics are in place, essentially. So the argument becomes far more substantial than just talking about a crisis. Yes, there is a crisis, but then there are these other things happening as well. So you see blackouts and you see electricity breakdowns and you see technological collapse and you see state disconnect. But then there are these other things happening in which roads are being built and highways are being developed, and there is a great deal of international investment taking place within the larger context of Pakistan's infrastructure development. And then you have these solid examples of state firm relational engagements in which infrastructures are repaired and redeployed, the building of airports, the building of roads. So trying to bring these narratives together to build a more holistic picture and trying to understand where do we locate then infrastructure's ultimate progress of material progress, infrastructure's ultimate promise of material progress, which lies very much at the heart of modernity, you know, our modernity. So this, in essence, helped me to reshape the manuscript and, you know, to bring the core argument to the forefront by understanding infrastructures as something that is far more multidimensional and far more powerful thing, if I may call it that, than something that is purely positivist or economically driven or just purely economically grounded by focusing on the symbolic aspects, the issue of desire, the issue of seduction, but also connecting it and tying it with the larger sort of discourse of the larger developmental discourse of infrastructure, positioning it within that. So that's what, in essence, lies at the heart of the manuscript, and these driving, nagging questions of, you know, how do we reconcile this image of both an infrastructure crisis and progress, both things that kind of coexist in this very unstable political economic landscape that defines Pakistan's current industrializing conjuncture.
Okay, that's wonderful. And one of the ways in which you help us to reconceptualize and to rethink infrastructure in Pakistan is this concept that you bring up in the introduction, infrastructure fetishism. And we're going to talk a little bit about infrastructure in the two localities that you focus in the book. But I thought before we start to turn to these regions and look at the argument you make in these substantive chapters, could you tell us a little bit about what you mean by the concept of infrastructure fetishism?
Yeah, you know, what is interesting, I mean, it took me a while to actually realize that what I'm looking at is also sort of what I'm observing in these different landscapes, industrial landscapes, and in the conversations and my dealings with industrialists, different categories of industrialists in Punjab, was this thing called infrastructure fetishism. When I set out at the very first, in terms of doing my ethnographies and my interviews and my open-ended conversations, this is not what I had imagined that I would come up with eventually. And what I thought I was looking at initially when I started interviewing industrialists and starting to put together the bits and pieces of my research, the word that would come up in my mind was sort of almost infrastructure obsession. But I knew that that obsession was not an apt word, that it certainly, you know, almost, I mean, at times I would think that it was almost a psychosis, but that's not quite what it was. I mean, certainly the anxieties of infrastructure collapse, right? And the anxieties of modernity not being able to deliver on its promise, those were always evident to me in these landscapes. And but eventually, I think in the course of honing the argument of grappling with these questions of how do we sort of reconcile these very competing images of crisis and progress? How do we kind of make, how do we not necessarily unite, but make sense of these competing narratives? The notion of infrastructure fetishism really kind of snapped up in front of me that, yes, I think perhaps it's better to define this as a fetishism rather than as some kind of a psychosis or an obsession. And essentially, when I come up with this concept, what I'm suggesting in the book is that in this larger context of an infrastructure crisis in Pakistan, and then perhaps also it can be used in the context of many other countries across the global south, which are experiencing similar dynamics of problems of an infrastructure crisis, that in the context of infrastructure crisis that is mired in these technological disruptions and these breakdowns and this desire for repair and this need for, you know, for constant sort of desire for constant connectivity, that these anxieties about state disconnect, especially for industrialists, that in this entire landscape, infrastructures still continue to elicit very powerful visions of material progress. And they continue to fire the temporal imaginaries of connectivity and globalization. So in this sense, then, this crisis has generated a type of infrastructure fetishism across Pakistan's industrial landscape. But what I'm arguing is that this form of fetishism does not necessarily work in a Marxian materialist sense, where traditionally we can understand an infrastructure fetishism, you know, in terms of a political economic apparatus that might mask the state's sovereignty, or where the road or the airport or the highway can be seen as a fetishized commodity that often makes invisible the conditions of construction. So here I'm not necessarily disagreeing with the Marxist reading of infrastructure fetishism, because I also acknowledge in the book that infrastructures are in essence material technologies upon which a superstructure is built. And scholars have shown us that when you know these technologies collapse or when they break down, it leads to deep uncertainties about progress and about how you know, futures materialize. And I certainly show this, for instance, when I examine the bifurcated, splintering landscapes of infrastructure and industrial development in the heartland of Pakistan's industrial core, which is Faisalabad in Punjab. And in terms of you know how the impact of that technological collapse, everyday life inside factories and shop floors become disrupted and disconnected, and they start kind of literally falling apart. What I'm trying to say instead is that you know, in using the concept of infrastructure fetishism, I'm saying something slightly different. And what I'm saying is this: that in the context of this persistent crisis, the infrastructures that have been in a state of decay, for instance, roads, electricity, ports, that I talk about in subsequent chapters in the book and the case studies, that these very fragile technologies, and these technologies are very fragile, and anthropologists have continued to underscore that the sort of symbolic nature of these technologies is very hard, you know, it's very hard to keep them stable because these technologies are extremely fragile. That the industrialists have, you know, in the cases of Faisalabad and Sialkot, for instance, and especially Sialkot, they have reappropriated these technologies in ways that have enabled them to invest these roads and these ports and, you know, airports with their own desires and dreams and visions of progress. So here I'm, you know, in using the term infrastructure fetishism, I'm drawing attention to the symbolic and seductive effects of infrastructure through which a certain kind of fetishism is constituted. And then I go on by taking this a step further by arguing that that industrialists' involvement in the reconstruction and privatization of infrastructure, such as roads and ports, for instance, this process also links them with the state. And this is very important. I mean, I emphasize the importance of these linkages that arise, you know, in the context of this infrastructure fetishism. And this creates also the basis for reimagining the state as a pragmatic force, you know, that paves the way for a competitive global economic order. And in arguing this, I stress the importance of this linkage because it creates the basis, essentially, for reinvigorating the promise of speed and connectivity, which is also, in essence, a fundamental promise of infrastructure in terms of its importance to our modernity, you know, for a very long time. So I point, you know, in the subsequent chapters to the materialities and politics of this infrastructure fetishism that plays a key role in reconstituting state-firm relational engagements to repair infrastructures and in amplifying the narrative force of the promise of progress and development. So in essence, what I'm trying to do is locate those moments in which we can reimagine how infrastructures reinvigorate the promise of progress. And so it's not always about crisis. So how can we rethink the role of the state in those moments? And in this, I also connect with certain arguments that that certain geographers and anthropologists have also provided. And those are also very potent and important arguments to take into consideration in terms of the repairs and reconstructions of infrastructure that enable us to build those linkages, that enable those state-society connectivities, that enable those state-firm engagements in the context of my own research.
Excellent. Yeah, the idea certainly, I mean, I work in South India, but this idea that definitely resonated a lot with when I started to think through what was happening in India as well. This idea of this fetishistic commodity. Yeah, it was. I think it's an idea that certainly works across many different contexts in the global south. But let's now move to turn to talk a little bit about chapter one. This is called History, Ideas and Visions. And this you talk in depth about another idea, what you call development as infrastructure, and how conceptions of infrastructure have changed in Pakistan since independence. So I was wondering if you can give us an overview of infrastructure's role and perceived role in Pakistan's development.
Yeah, so, you know, I was in the course of writing, again, thinking of the large argument of crisis and progress, I was trying to locate it in historical terms also, and that was a challenge because I didn't want to emphasize or to suggest simplistic causalities. That is one thing that I wanted to steer clear from. And I wanted to avoid this overriding desire to think in terms of, well, you know, how did this crisis arise? How, you know, why does this crisis exist? It happened because X happened and Y happened. And, you know, I mean, that would have suggested a more positivistic reading. And I wanted to stay clear from that. So in terms of locating this larger argument of crisis and progress in by anchoring it or mooring it in Pakistan's post-independence developmental history, I was trying to suggest that over the last 60 years, there have been multiple narratives or multiple ways of seeing the role of infrastructure in Pakistan's industrial development. And the connection with industrial development, of course, is very important. Because in the post-1947 context of Pakistan's reconstruction, the role of industrial development was put center stage by planners, policymakers, international experts. And certainly for Pakistan's policymakers and planners, and I talk about this in great detail in that chapter, the idea that you could move a backward Pakistan that was this sort of agricultural backwater of British India and especially Punjab, which is the primary region that I focus on in my book, by turning that agrarian backwater into an industrial leviathan, that lay at the heart of Pakistan's sort of progress and its visions for its future. So industrial development was an incredibly important and a very potent sort of policy-making, economic development dynamic. And The role of industrial development was also very closely tied with infrastructure development. So these issues were very closely aligned. They were tied together through a centralized planning paradigm. And a key aspect of this was basically to perceive development as infrastructure. And this set the tone for Pakistan's development priorities in the 1950s and 60s. And in turn, this pivoted on several factors that I describe and I talk about in that chapter. For instance, the economic development discourses of the 1950s, and over here I highlight, you know, the very potent development discourses put forth by economic development experts like Albert Hirschman and Rosenstein, Rodin, and others, and how these discourses kind of circulated not only internationally, but also very quietly, sort of. Made their way into official policy and the planning practice within Pakistan's bureaucratic structures. And in doing this, I'm not suggesting some kind of a clear link between ideas and policy-making outcomes, but suggesting that this larger narrative or this larger discourse of economic development as put forth by these great economists, these great thinkers, especially like Albert Hirschman, for instance, they were incredibly important, and they did have bearing on how sort of policy making was designed, and how ideas of economic development how economic development was thought about. So, development as infrastructure came to represent a very powerful and a very important vision for Pakistan's progress, but it was also very much a technocratic vision in which international experts played a very important role, in which entities like the World Bank and the Ford Foundation played a very important role. And I highlight this in that chapter. I sort of provide very specific examples of the role of World Bank experts and the Ford Foundation in the setting up of particular institutions within Pakistan, research institutions, for instance, and the funding of infrastructure, development projects, etc. But in the course of this, this whole process of this story of development as infrastructure, as a very powerful a part of Pakistan's infrastructure history, infrastructure also then became a kind of a very depoliticized thing, a very neutral description for various rudiments to economic growth. And this in large part was also tied to World Bank financing. And this depoliticization then ultimately also served the interests of an authoritarian ruler. So I focused, specifically on the 1960s, which is in Pakistan noted as the decade of development, sort of as many people today, have a great nostalgia for Ayub Khan's decade of development, the golden era of development that is cited repeatedly, by many people, economists especially, as that decade, that promised to bear, a very golden future for Pakistan, but of course a decade that never quite bore those kinds of fruits, for specific reasons that I elaborate in that chapter. And this distinct idea of a future that was going to arrive on time was also very much embedded in notions of capitalist accumulation, tied to a certain mode of authoritarian rule. And by the end of the 1960s, this decade of development had collapsed and Ayub Khan's era had come to an end. And with that, there was a disjuncture. This was a period of enormous disjuncture in Pakistan's political economy and its development. I don't wish to I do suggest that this was it was in essence a watershed period in Pakistan's political economy and its history. And that was also it ultimately did also affect the whole the story of development as infrastructure, and that is also something that I talk about and I highlight in detail in that chapter. So that in the post-Ayub phase, what we begin to see are new types of discourses emerge in which the role of infrastructure is mired in deeper uncertainties, where it is harder and harder then to stabilize its symbolic aspects, to come up with policies that can mimic the effects of the 1950s and 60s. All of that becomes far more complicated for a variety of reasons that, again, I go on to talk about. Shifting regimes from civilian to short-term military to structural adjustment programs, to corruption, narratives of corruption, disruptions in notions of a moral economy, and so on and so forth. And a key question that I raise then, in that chapter, and then I come back to in the conclusion, is that what then does infrastructure signify today? If we can no longer see development as infrastructure, if the story of development as infrastructure is a story that has in essence collapsed, then how do we define infrastructure today? How do we signify it today? Because in the Pakistani context, and I think again in the context of other countries across the global south, today infrastructure has taken on this sort of the narrative force of competitiveness, of growth, of globalization. And one of the challenges that I think we face today is how do we map infrastructure back into vocabulary for thinking about it as a state-led project, which I think is very important and very necessary, because the state has a critical role to play in this. And I point this out again and again in my case studies, where I show that where there is no state involvement, you have deep problems of disconnectivity, of disruption and disrepair and so on and so forth. So this issue of what does infrastructure signify today, if it no longer signifies a story of development and infrastructure, is a key question that I raise through this chapter and towards the end of my book as well.
Mm-hmm. And that takes us on perfectly to start looking at one of the case studies. Your first case study is in Sialkot. Mm-hmm. And in this chapter, through analysis of roads and of ports, you're highlighting exactly what you just talked about then, these state-firm collaborations. Now, first of all, I was wondering, can you tell us a little bit about the place, about Sialkot? I mean, I think many of us maybe don't know that as well as your other case study in Faisalabad, and then tell us what these collaborations are and what they tell us about infrastructure development.
You know, one of the, before I go on to talk a little bit about Sialkot, one of my motivations in picking Punjab as the site of my research and my graphic engagements was also because of the pre-partition and post-partition context, because both these industrializing regions of Pakistan, both Faisalabad and Sialkot, represent very important industrial regions in Pakistan's history, and even in India's history, in the pre-independence British India's history, and looking at the pre-partition colonial post-colonial context enables us to see the trajectory of industrial development and its sort of its relational aspects with infrastructure development over the past 60 plus years. It helps us to kind of locate ourselves and these regions in a historical context, and that's very important to see kind of how how you can start thinking about change, how you can start thinking about issues of globalization and problematizing and so on. So both Sialkot and then later when we come to Faisalabad are very important industrial regions in Pakistan. But Sialkot was also an incredibly important industrial region in the colonial era. And sort of Sialkot's industries, even in the colonial context, had an incredibly important role to play in the British era. So, in the post-independence context, Sialkot once again sort of rises in Pakistan, emerges in Pakistan, in the region of Punjab, as a key industrial center, but one which comprises predominantly small and medium-scale enterprises, or SMEs, which are essentially family-led firms. And just to sort of give our audience who are not entirely familiar with Pakistan, those who are, would hardly need an introduction. Sialkot essentially lies in the northeastern part of Pakistan, Punjab, very close to the Indian Jammu and Kashmir border. And it consists largely of four sub-districts. And most of the district's population is concentrated in the city of Sialkot. And we haven't had a census in Pakistan since 1998, but the population, its estimated population, is about 800,000. And so it's a very important city in terms of its clusters of different export-oriented manufacturers. And these manufacturing establishments, which have a very distinct colonial genealogy, range from a very dynamic sports goods sector to which exports footballs to all over the globe, and two clusters of manufacturers that that produce surgical instruments to cutleries and hunting knives to steel products, light engineering merchandise, and so on and so forth. And looking at Sialkot is very important because SMEs comprise a very important part of Pakistan's industrial landscape. You know, they are, I hate to use the word, engines of growth, because that kind of puts us right back into that sort of very controversial discourse of competitiveness and so forth. But SMEs are very important to Pakistan's industrial development. And in that sense, I think, again, across the global south, even if we look at India, for instance, equally important because of larger issues of poverty alleviation and generating jobs in local markets and so on and so forth. So looking at SMEs, small and medium scale firms, and then kind of juxtaposing them with larger firms was a very important issue for me. Because the dynamics, the mediatic qualities of infrastructure and how state firm relational engagements happen in the context of these small guys and then the big guys is also a very important issue, and it certainly has important policy implications aside from the importance of looking at the historical narratives of how these firms and these industrial clusters have emerged, the last 100 plus years. So looking at Sialkot, I focus predominantly on the sports goods sector, and Sialkot is it's a very important regional industrial center. Its per capita income is pretty high. It's about US dollars 2,800, and so in that sense, it represents a relatively prosperous industrial district dominated by family-run small and medium-scale enterprises, that are engaged in diverse production activities. And in that sense, the city is also slightly different from Faisalabad in terms of its higher levels of prosperity. And so looking at the sports goods sector, just to give you an idea, these firms produce approximately 70% of the world's high-quality footballs. So, and these are suppliers to premium, global brands like Adidas, Nike, Puma, Graze, Reebok, Mitre, you name it. And that's what these firms are doing. And nearly 85% of exports from this particular sector, the sports goods sector, which is located in Sialkot, are destined for markets in the United States and Western Europe. So when we look at these SMEs or these small and medium-scale enterprises, and then we compare them later on to those small and medium-scale enterprises in Faisalabad's textile, export-oriented textile sector, we see a very different kind of a dynamic. In Sialkot, we see SMEs that occupy a very privileged position, in the value chain as direct exporters to global markets. And when we compare them to the SMEs in Faisalabad, they occupy a position which is far less privileged in terms of these value chains that have these global connectivities to global markets, and et cetera. So when I was looking at the sports goods sector and also marginally at the surgical instrument sector in Pakistan, what I became interested in was, when we think about SMEs and we think about industrial regions like Sialkot, historically and then relationally and then in contemporary terms, how can we imagine, how can we think about, in the present conjuncture, Pakistan's present conjuncture, which is marked by fiscal crises and structural adjustment programs and differentiated structures of governance, such as privatization and liberalization and extensive breakdowns in infrastructure. So where we have a landscape in which the signs of technological collapse are very evident, public electricity is intermittent and very expensive, road breakdowns are, you can observe them everywhere, ports barely function, and everywhere in the industrial context, people talk about, a state that is absent or disconnected from local industrial context. So in looking at the Sialkot case study, what I was trying to grapple with essentially was that in this present conjuncture of an infrastructure crisis then, how can we think about the role of infrastructure and its mediatic qualities? How do these technologies then mediate state-fund relations? And how can we think about how these technologies reinvigorate visions of development? And so in raising this question then, what I've tried to do in this chapter, and the way that I've tried to argue, is that also looking at the context of looking at these mediatic qualities and these state fund relation engagements in the context of reciprocal arrangements that have historically structured relations of power between state officials and capitalist firms. Essentially, that has been a very important part of this entire book. Again, this whole discourse of crisis progress, pivoting on the dynamics of political patronage. So then the repair and the reconstruction and the redeployment of infrastructure then begins to constitute a very important dimension of this relationship in which politics of patronage play a very important role. And then I go on then to point to this whole issue of infrastructure fetishism amongst industrialists, where I talk about how the subject of broken down roads and ports has been discussed perpetually by the city's entrepreneurs, in not just in the sports goods sector, but across these multiple clusters of whether it's surgical instruments or whatever. And these discussions that have been ongoing for the last 20 plus years, have also been a preoccupation of local government, which has confronted over the last 30, 40 years, shrinking resources, limited capacities, in which the city's road infrastructure has, especially in the 1980s and 1990s, had literally collapsed. So it's these mundane workings of road repair and port construction that I look at in this chapter, which over the last 20, 30 years have become a very lively zone for state fund relational engagements in the industrial district of Sialkot. And in this context, then, I assess the viability of the transformations of, the road infrastructure, the building of airports and the building of dry ports, and how these become points of exchange that facilitate geographical connectivity, in a global context. But then I also elaborate this, in terms of this increasingly, this increasing thing of a fetishistic and progress-driven dimension of infrastructure that is increasingly privatized. And by privatized, I don't mean privatization in the conventional sense, but privatized in the sense that literally the idea of progress is privatized. It is internalized by industrialists, and it is privatized also in the sense that industrialists or firms use their own private resources in conjunction with public resources to rebuild and repair these infrastructures, and that really is the heart of this chapter, essentially.
Thank you. So let's now talk a little bit about the next case study. This is what you explore in chapter 3, and this, as you mentioned before, is Faisalabad, and this is sort of a great textile region of Pakistan. And here the focus shifts away from roads and onto electricity. So first, could you tell us a little bit about the place? I mean, I'm sure many people, even if they're not familiar with the region, will know it as this Manchester of Pakistan and so on. But tell us a little bit about the place and also why electricity, or rather, I suppose, electricity shortage is such a crucial issue here.
So in this chapter, essentially, which again shifts to, although sort of still geographically centered in industrializing Punjab, now looking at a very different part of Punjab, looking at, as you very correctly highlighted, what is many times labeled as the Manchester of Pakistan, which is essentially Faisalabad. And again, it's, in this chapter, I highlight its pre-colonial, its colonial and post-colonial histories, and which is essentially the pre-partition, post-partition context, being a very important one. And Faisalabad's textile industry developed after independence. It developed in the post-1947 context. And in that sense, the rise of this industry is very different to what we see happening in Sialkot, where the sports goods sector and the surgical instrument sector, etc., have very distinct colonial genealogies. So in Faisalabad, we see the rise of an export-oriented textile industry, which has distinct post-partition bearings, but also, tied to its agrarian, the larger agrarian landscape, the conditions of industrial development that take off in the 1950s and that I've highlighted in the previous chapter on history, on ideas and visions and progress, which is essentially chapter one. So why electricity? Why do I shift from roads to and ports to electricity? One of the things that I highlight in the opening chapter of my book is that when we think about the larger issue of crisis and progress, these contradictory narratives of crisis and progress, looking at the broader landscape of Pakistan's infrastructure development, whether it is in a historical context or whether we put it in a more contemporary context, this these contradictory narratives are also marked by certain types of infrastructure. So roads and highways and ports represent a very different kind of story. They represent a story of progress, essentially, in this current conjuncture. Whereas electricity in the current Pakistani context has come to represent the penultimate sort of example of state failure and a sort of a collapse of the larger moral economy of Pakistan's industrial landscape. And choosing Faisalabad or locating my work in Faisalabad is helped me to sort of interrogate these issues further, to examine them in a more situated context, because this is, after all, the industrial heartland of Pakistan. So the electricity crisis in Pakistan has been ongoing now for the last 20 years. And in this chapter, I locate Faisalabad's textile industrial landscape through its historical connectivities, both in the pre- and post-partition context, looking at how these technologies have developed and looking at both the rise of large firms and the small and medium-scale enterprises like the powerloom sector, which really is the backbone of this industry and comprises entirely small firms, which the industry has depended upon for the last 40, 50 years of its development. But also what is now the literal collapse of this this entire SME sector, the powerloom manufacturers, whose reliance on electricity cannot be mediated in the same way that has happened for the large firms. Because because of the politics of patronage, in which large firms have always positioned themselves in a very different relationship to the Pakistani state historically, but also because of the nature of technology. As electricity has been unbundled, as it has been privatized, you see the onset of new types of generation technology, not only across the world, but in terms of its adaptation into Pakistan's industrial heartland. You see its usage, its deployment in very different ways by large firms and by small and medium scale enterprises. So the story of these of technological collapse and the crisis of the moral economy that surrounds this narrative of crisis, which pivots on electricity essentially, then the way that the story connects in terms of Pakistan industrial heartland, I believe, and this is what I try to show in this chapter, is very succinctly represented in terms of the variations and the differences between these large firms and these small firms, and how they adapt or are unable to adapt and bring these technologies, into their everyday lives. So for the powerloom manufacturers, the SME powerloom manufacturers that really define are the backbone of this industry, it is literally impossible for them to use privatized technologies, to use generators, because of the nature of electricity production. It's just too expensive for them. And they're kind of left out of the larger domain of the politics of patronage. They're simply not able to tap into structures of patronage in the same way that larger firms have been able to do historically in Faisalabad. And then I go on to discuss precisely how and why this has happened and where technology fits into this larger story. So these technological mediations then have, in terms of the infrastructure crisis and that relating specifically to the story of Faisalabad, then is mired in a kind of a splintering of the industrial landscape as well. So where you see the emergence of premium network spaces of large firms and very uneven technological conditions, rising insecurity, greater precarity, especially for those who who define the lived experience of the male powerloom workers. And then I take up this larger issues in my chapter on labor. And what I argue essentially is that this, in terms of this splintering landscape, industrial landscape of Faisalabad, you see these premium network spaces and these uneven technological conditions and this very distinct hierarchy of large firms and SMEs and a very uneven landscape of political patronage. I call this a kind of a space of fluctuating connectivity, you know, in which you see certain marginalized sectors and places and people which become very, which are very abruptly disconnected, you know, as technological circumstances change in essence. And these complex interdependencies then between electricity infrastructure, the state, and contemporary industrial life in Pakistan suggests, you know, a very critical reconfiguration in terms of these relational engagements as represented through the prism of this particular kind of infrastructure, which is electricity. So what we're seeing in Pakistan today in terms of what is happening in Faisalabad and generally across Pakistan is a changing boundaries of states, citizen-state relationships in which electricity breakdowns have become very, very prominent. And what do they signify? What they signify, in fact, is that the state is no longer in control over the electricity-consuming population, in which you have large firms and more privileged industrial landscapes that are able to privatize electricity, that are able to bring generators, you know, into factories and onto shop floors and are able to disconnect themselves from the industrial grid, from the electricity grid. And then you have smaller firms that are unable to do so because of a variety of reasons, which also involves issues of state patronage. So in this, I'm suggesting that electricity infrastructure, especially as a modernist project, which once represented visions of a strong developmental state, you know, as it was represented, for instance, in the story of development as infrastructure, that vision has now weakened considerably as represented through the prism of this particular infrastructure. And that is not necessarily the case for roads and ports and highways and so on and so forth. And that, you know, then in a larger sense connects with this story of crisis and progress in which you see these sort of, a very contradictory and very contested landscape and a domain of fragmented public authority as well, and stolen electricity, privatized governance, you know, etc., in which state officials especially then award contracts to foreign companies to build expensive large-scale electricity infrastructure projects like the independent power projects that I highlight in this chapter. And what I suggest essentially is that these projects, especially these, like these independent power projects, have come to symbolize a form of extraction in which state officials, large-scale manufacturers, and foreign companies are embedded in patron-client networks that generate immense profits. And within then this larger industrial landscape, you begin to see certain types of sectors and certain types of clusters that are increasingly left out of these, you know, privileged networks, of these privileged patron-client networks. So for certain firms then, you know, in the heartland of industrial Pakistan, which is Faisalabad, so power breakdowns and fluctuations symbolize state disconnect. And this is very different from the story that I represent on Sialkot and its roads and its port developments. And this process has generated a devastating series of consequences for the quality of industrial life in Pakistan. It is a process that has forced the elite resource-rich exporters essentially to secure private, uninterruptible sources of power that facilitate mobility and communication and enable them to partake in globalized production networks. And these are the firms that I call these premium network, you know, that constitute what I call premium networked spaces of economic exchange. And these networked spaces are relationally connected to globally distant places, and they're embedded in circuits of global capitalist production. And then, you know, you see the other spaces, which I call the spaces of fluctuating connectivity, which are increasingly marginalized as represented, you know, in the stories of the powerloom workers and the powerloom manufacturers. And this in turn has had a very unexpected consequences in terms of this splintering landscape, and that it has led to the creation of two classes of industrial citizens. Those that are considered rational actors in the world of globalized production and competition, which are essentially the large-scale exporters, and those who are not, you know, such as the, you know, the powerloom manufacturers of the small-scale powerloom weavers, who are, so in essence, those who are able to speak the language of global competition and are therefore capable of participation in the new phase of capitalist accumulation that represents Pakistan's current conjuncture of competitiveness and so on and so forth. And those who cannot and are therefore marginalized in terms of their inability to participate in the technological transformations that necessitate global connectivity. So in this context, then, contemporary Faisalabad's splintering industrial landscape that pivots on these technological connectivities and technological collapses, it represents a new conjuncture of urban industrial life in Pakistan that is networked by unstable infrastructures. And there are sort of, you know, in this networked infrastructures, one of the things that I argue is that you have these sort of superimpositions or layerings, you know, of old and new technologies, old industrial spaces, new industrial spaces, and mounting anxieties and greater political unrest and so on and so forth. So this is a very different kind of industrial space and a very different kind of infrastructure dynamic that I describe in this chapter on Faisalabad in this particular case study, in comparison with what I have described when I talked about Sialkot in the earlier chapter.
Thanks for that. Now, the focus changes slightly in the fourth chapter. This is called With a Labour, and you analyse labour regulations in the light of global trade production networks. And the speed of these production networks is fascinating in itself, as well as the effects on labour regulation. Now, my question here is really very broad. It's how has trade liberalisation affected industrial labour in Pakistan? But also, I was just wondering, just because I'm slightly conscious of time, because we've been talking for quite a while, could you be quite brief here, just so we can move on, because I'm really interested in the sort of the policy implications of your book. So just give us a very short answer on labour, and then we can talk a little bit about your policy implications of your work.
Right. So you have to be a very important dimension of this book. I mean, I think that one can't possibly engage in any context, whether that is of Pakistan or elsewhere, with issues of industrial development, whether it is in connection with infrastructure or otherwise, and not look at the issue of labour. So so labor continually has remained a very important aspect of my work. So what was the motivation? Aside from the fact that it is a very important subject. So looking at the textile the export oriented dimensions of Pakistan's textiles industry, the issue of the global factory for one represents a very important issue. And secondly, the rise of the global factory in terms of globalization and Pakistan's own liberalization dynamics is a very important issue in this chapter that I have highlighted. So the structural changes that have emerged over the last couple of decades in Pakistan, which are akin to what has been happening in other nations across the world also, for instance, in East Asia, countries in East Asia and Latin America, and several others, countries which have been drawn into circuits of global production, but in Pakistan under the auspices of domestic capital and straight different agendas. So the importance over here is how these agendas in Pakistan, for instance, have sought to capture the benefits of export-led industrialization. And for facilitating increased employment, foreign exchange flows, and so on and so forth. And in Pakistan, the garment industry, for instance, textile garment industry, has been a natural choice for the state's policymaking agendas vis-a-vis liberalization and export-oriented industrialization because of its high global mobility and export orientation. And this has had important implications in terms of the globalization of production, for Pakistan, how Pakistan's global factories have emerged in this context. And examples of these are situated in the heartland of Pakistan's industrial sector, which is Faisalabad. So what has this meant for firms and for labor? The liberalization policies in Pakistan, for instance, have manifested themselves in the lifting of industry subsidies, trade and quota regulations, license restrictions, for instance, which have pushed firms to become more competitive by reducing production costs, retrenching formerly employed factory workers, hiring on a contractual basis. These things have become quite pervasive in Pakistan's industrial sector. And this is more pervasive, for instance, in the export-oriented industries like garment production. So what this has meant, essentially, is that firms are no longer required to extend benefits or minimum wages or job security to factory workers. And in this context, the state is also perceived as being increasingly absent in the realm of production politics, as having retreated from its earlier role as a major labor protector. So, liberalization policies that were initiated first in the 1980s under General Zia ul Haq's regime, and then these were propelled, further under in the 2000s under General Pervez Musharraf's time in power. And these now continue to accelerate in the present conjuncture under the present Nawaz Sharif government. So in this, in this larger schema, the textile garment industry is geared almost exclusively for the global market. And one of the concerns that has been highlighted by scholars and activists is this trepidation that following the case of countries in Latin America and African countries, Pakistan too will see mounting unemployment and inflation and increased informalization of work and the decline of formal sector employment. And a key element of this, for instance, in Pakistan is already visible in terms of how Pakistan has curtailed or held in abeyance certain labor laws and to push strategies of competitiveness, which actually don't allow labor to come to the forefront in terms of lodging complaints and taking issues to court and so on and so forth. And these are some of the things that I highlight in this chapter. But also looking at those intersections between global labor laws global strategies of regulation and local labor laws, and how we can think about the interaction between these different types of technologies of regulation and how these are interpreted in the context of what's happening inside the factory and the shop floor.
Great, wonderful. that was a condensed chapter. Then, I recommend, of course, like always, we only ever get books on the show that are very good. But of course, as always, the nature of a podcast, we're skipping over a lot of things and a lot of the details, and especially this chapter also has conversations with the workers and so on. So I'd recommend that listeners really check out the book and the chapters itself to get more information. So this book is also written not just with an academic audience in mind, I suppose, but you also want some sort of discourse with policymakers. So I was wondering, what would you like policymakers to take away from your study?
Yeah, very, very quickly. And I think one of the core issues, core points that I highlight in my conclusion, is the whole idea of pragmatic policymaking, and using the user heuristic as an important point of engagement. And by using the word user heuristic, what I'm essentially saying is that how can we think about designing infrastructure solutions in the context of an infrastructure crisis? Infrastructure solutions that can be fast-tracked, they don't necessarily have to engage with the current obsession that is in countries like Pakistan, mega projects which take up a lot of money, that require a great deal of state expenditure, which the state itself has taken on huge debts. That how can we think of fast tracking solutions by engaging the idea of user friendly, user designed, user designed solutions? And in this, I take up the user heuristic by pointing to the idea that that once technologies, infrastructure technologies get out there, once they start circulating, once technological systems are put to use, they generate their own visions. They start, and technology users start generating their own visions about what technology is about. So in this context, users should not be seen as powerless pawns of technological systems, but active agents of technological change. So in making these policy recommendations, I'm trying to highlight the adaptability of infrastructure technologies to create new networks of exchange within industrial communities in industrializing Pakistan, highlighting the adaptability of generation technology, for instance, electricity generation technology that could enable, that has already enabled large firms to surmount the challenge of poor quality infrastructure, but in which small firms, for instance, the small and medium-scale power loom manufacturers and others have been kind of bypassed in this globalizing infrastructure landscape. And in making these policy recommendations, I highlight certain simple ways in which these other firms that are very important in terms of the industrial regions in which they in which they reside, in which they work, how they can be incorporated into an all-inclusive grid. And you know, in this, I try and stray away I don't want to put it this way as an advice, but a sort of a recommendation that I think one of the mistakes that we make in terms of designing infrastructure solutions is to think in terms of cookie cutter strategies. And I think this is the pitfalls of policymaking everywhere in most contexts. So how can we think in terms of facilitating policy-oriented solutions that fit into the particular context of a given region in terms of its particular histories, in terms of its particular demands, and those distinct types of dynamics, such as those that I described, for instance, in terms of the different hierarchies of small and large firms in Faisalabad and the very privileged networks of SMEs in Sialkot, that these different kinds of hierarchies suggest different kinds of solutions, because these are differently oriented firms, different relations with the state, different relations within their industrial sectors, different relationships with the different types of infrastructures. So it is in that context that I've provided a range of ideas for thinking about fast tracking solutions, both in terms of electricity as well as roads and ports. And I don't want to get into that in too much detail, because I know we have an issue of time over here.
Yes, that's wonderful. Thank you so much, Nashin. This was a wonderful discussion. And again, I'd like to recommend this book to our listeners. I think it speaks to not only people who are interested in the region, but also those who are interested in anthropology of development, or also human geographies or development studies in general. I think there's really a lot, conceptually and theoretically, and of course from the case studies itself, that many people will be interested in. So without any, this, all I have left to do is to thank you for coming on the show, and thank you again for your wonderful book.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Thanks so much for downloading the New Books in South Asian Studies podcast. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Today we've been listening to Infrastructure Redux, Crisis Progress in Industrial Pakistan and Beyond by Nashin H. Anwar. Thanks again for downloading, and hope to see you again next time. Ta-ra!